This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello, welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Today we meet jungle midwife Monica Parker. 5 years ago, she was working a cushy job at Westmead. Now she's living in the jungles of Burma, saving the lives of women and children. She'll share the moments of triumph and the moments of heartbreak, working in a country where one in 25 women still die in childbirth. Are we raising a generation of spoilt brats? Australian psychologist Michael Carr-Gregg says we're a generation of crap parents who need to learn to grow a spine and say no more often. We discussed that with psychologist Colette Smart from Family Smart. More than a quarter of all Australians are living alone, and that number continues to rise in all age groups. We find out how to live alone without being lonely, thanks to Joanna Hayes from celibateinthecity.net. The parliamentary inquiry into homeschooling suggests the number of kids being homeschooled may be far more than are registered. We'll discuss homeschooling, why you do it, and what you got out of it. And we delve deep into the spiritual aspects of fostering creativity with musician Michael Gungor, author of The Crowd, The Critic and The Muse, a book for creators. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly Podcast. It's been 5 years since Monica Parker left her job as a midwife at Westmead Hospital and went off to live in the jungles of Burma with the Karen people. Her role still involves looking after pregnant women and delivering babies, but sometimes she has to hike over a mountain range for a week to get to her patients. Monica's official job title is Director of Nursing with the Free Burma Rangers. Hi, Mon.
Hi, Katrina.
I bet that's not a job title you ever expected to hold when you were working as a midwife at Westmead.
No, not at all.
What's the job description? What do you actually do?
Anything health related, really. The title Director of Nursing feels more of a joke because at the moment I'm the only nurse. So I'm directing myself.
But you are directing a pretty big operation, aren't you? I mean, you travel all over the place. You deal with all sorts of different situations. You've got to be pretty flexible, right?
Very flexible.
What's the political situation like now? Because news outlets here often say that it's becoming more stable, and you'll even hear people talking about tourism and sort of getting into Burma now because, you know, it's all opening up. But is that...
Central locations are opening up. The ethnic areas are still pretty much off limits.
So central areas, you mean like the big cities?
Yeah. Or? So it's easier to travel in Yangon and up to Mandalay and in those areas that are Burma controlled. Once you get to the ethnic areas, it's unlikely that as a tourist you'll get to go there. Look, in Karen State, that's, you know, you have some minor altercations still happening, but, you know, up north in Kachin State, you still have a lot of brutal fighting in northern Shan State. And then the situation with the Rohingya in Arakan State is, you know, it's pretty terrible. It's not active fighting, it's just, you know, severe brutal oppression.
Okay, but what about where you are?
Where I am, you wouldn't know it's conflict where I am. It's a really nice, peaceful location, and it's good because it means that people are free to travel to us to get healthcare.
Now, I understand that you've had a bit of trouble with the wildlife from time to time. What sort of challenges do you have with that?
For a little while, I had snakes that like to come into my house.
Are they poisonous?
Well, as one of my friends told me, look, Thramun, don't worry. It will bite you, but it will not kill you. It will just make you very sick, cause a lot of swelling, a lot of pain. Sometimes in bad cases, we will need to remove the limb, but it will not kill you. Don't worry.
Oh, great. So the snakes are under control. And now the chickens are causing you some problems.
The chickens like to come into the clinic. It kind of drives me up the wall. And everyone wonders why I get upset. They're just chickens from you. They're not going to do any harm.
So for them, it's quite normal to have chickens in a health clinic.
Yeah.
So getting to the serious stuff, Monica, can you tell us about, I guess, a time when you've known that your presence has made a big difference, when you've really been able to, you know, saved the life of a mother or a baby?
Okay, probably the most significant one of late was I'd only just arrived at our clinic and someone came running and said, Thramu, come, we've got a dizzy lady. And I said, oh, at the clinic? And they're like, no, on the other side of camp. And so the other side of camp turned into a 40-minute walk. There was just like multiple people wailing and beating their chests and there was a lady lying on the ground. And I took one look and I knew. But everyone kept saying she just kept trying to get out of the hammock. She tried to get out of the hammock. It was a pregnant girl, maybe 19 years old, and She was a clamp dick, and she wasn't trying to get out of the hammock. She was having seizures. So it took a lot to get her back in the hammock, and she'd been having seizures probably for the majority of that day already. So it's
very far advanced.
Yeah, at least 10 seizures of significant length. And, you know, here, in Australia, we put up medicine pretty quickly, and if it's not controlling it, we just take them through for an emergency cesarean. For her, we didn't have that option, and just even trying to get her back to where my medicine was at the clinic took a little bit of persuasion. And, you know, mum's there and she's wailing and trying to push on the girl's belly, trying to push the baby out, because she recognised that to fix the problem, the baby needs to be out. We managed to get the guys to put her back in the hammock and carry her to the clinic. We gave some of the medicines just in a slightly different way to what we would give here.
Like a blood pressure medication?
Yeah, so we gave blood pressure medication called magnesium sulfate to, stop the seizures and reduce the inflammation. Some diazepam, Valium, and just monitored her and needed to induce her. And, you know, it was because of, working at Westmead Hospital just kind of prepared me for that. And was able to, do these things straight up. And when I was talking to the medical team back in Thailand, they were like, do we need to transfer her out? And, she was more at risk of being transferred out, and we could probably do more for her by treating her right now and inducing her. So I just went ahead and we did that. And there were some hairy moments, but she delivered, and she delivered a live baby, and he's happy and healthy, and
and she was okay?
She was okay.
It sounds like from where she was, you would think that her life would have been in danger.
Yeah, I was sure that we were going to end up with just maybe a live mum, maybe not, but I was surprised that the baby would survive, but that she came out with no deficit was remarkable to me, yeah.
Yeah, and who pays for all those medications that you supplied?
Well, all those medications probably totaled to maybe $10 worth of medication in Thailand. So,
and yet if you weren't there, she would not have had access to any of those things.
No.
Yeah, it would have been a very different outcome. With those such limited resources, I can't help thinking there must be times when you just don't have what you need to deal with the situation. And yeah, have there been some moments of heartbreak where you've wished that you could have done more?
Oh, there's been plenty of moments of heartbreak, and it's exacerbated by the fact that, these people have got to walk sometimes a day, 2 days to get to the clinic, and the climate, affects it as well. So it's not just not having, enough supplies or, being able to do everything you would like to do. It's the combination of them arriving late. And
so if it rains a lot, they might not leave for 2 days or something.
So, just recently we had a baby who had whooping cough and malaria, and mum and dad were waiting for the rain to clear because they had to come a full day's fast walk to get to us. And unfortunately, we were able to start treating their little girl, but it was her body was in too much distress, and we weren't able to actually
save her.
If we could have intubated her and put her on a respirator, then possibly we could have. But
so if they had have arrived at Westmead Children's, maybe.
But then maybe Westmead Children's don't know how to manage malaria. So
yes, that's true.
But and then someone from the same village arriving the next day and arriving. If they'd arrived a day later, they probably would, that little boy probably wouldn't have made it. But they arrived the day earlier and were able to see this remarkable, remarkable difference in treatment. So, outcome.
Wow. So what have you learned from living immersed in the local culture? What have you kind of picked up in terms of values and the way that they live that's really influenced you?
The capacity of your heart to live on heart-based decisions is probably one of the key things. These guys, they don't decide, I'll get to know you and then I'll decide if I like you. They start loving on you the moment that they meet you, and everything comes back to the heart. Sometimes that's difficult in the health arena, but the capacity for my heart to, feel and be compassionate instead of closing down to everything that I see. I just find that, they've encouraged me to open my heart and continue to come from a place of love rather than, just duty or
fear. And so is there anything that we can do to help support you?
Prayer is always good. finances are always good. Mm-hmm. I work through a group, Partners Relief and Development. So their website is partnersworld.org.au.
Partnersworld.org.au. Thank you so much for coming in to share your story, Monica.
Thanks, Katrina.
Okay. That's Monica Parker. She's a midwife and she's the Director of Nursing with the Free Burma Rangers. You can find out more or support Monica's work at partnersworld.org.au. Are we raising a generation of spoiled brats? Australian psychologist Michael Carr-Gregg says Australian parents need to set more boundaries, stop being doormats to their kids and say no more often. Otherwise, there may be serious consequences for Australia's future. Psychologist Colette Smart from Family Smart is on the line to discuss this. Hi, Colette.
Hi, Katrina.
Do you agree with Michael Carr-Gregg that Australian kids are overindulged by their parents?
Well, I think I'm going to answer your question in two parts. So the word that Michael used are, we're being crap parents. Now, that's been all over the media at the moment, except I think a lot of what we're seeing in the media is sensationalist. He might have said that, but there's a whole lot that he has said that is fantastic. So I do believe parents today are trying to be different to past generations, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, the one downside about him actually saying that we're crap parents is we already feel a lot of guilt and failure as parents. We're trying harder than ever, aren't we?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I think we saw children being seen and not heard and, you know, grandparents' generations, their children's opinions weren't welcome. They weren't even allowed. Mm. Children, I think, now are being encouraged a lot more to be part of family discussions, talk about their feelings and fears and being treated as people. And I do think that's healthy. However, I do have to say, I think that there is an issue with some parents swinging the pendulum a bit too far the other way and acting like their child's best friend. So being afraid to say no or give consequences to poor choices. So what I sometimes see is children and teens being treated as adults when they're actually not cognitively or developmentally ready to make these adult decisions. So parents are giving them too much power in some cases, and kids are being allowed to make decisions around their behaviour and their schooling and their socialising that actually are not healthy.
That's interesting. So what do you think are some examples of times when it might be important for parents to actually put their foot down and say no?
So one thing I love of Michael's is Michael Carr-Gregg talks about healthy doses of vitamin N, which is basically giving children healthy doses of no. And not just saying no for the sake of saying no, but I think it is vital in parenting to say no when you're making a decision, when you have your child's future adult in mind. That's my phrase. So saying yes might stop a tantrum now, for example, but sometimes I think we need to stop and ask ourselves, what is my child actually learning long-term by being allowed to continually get away with rude behavior or spending hours and hours with entertainment media or going to bed whenever they choose? I think sometimes we give in because we don't want our child to feel pain or upset now, but then we're setting them up for a future of pain because we don't teach them that the world doesn't revolve around them and their feelings right now.
Yeah, I guess it's a lack of discipline, isn't it? It's the lack of being able to put the need of something else you have to do ahead of what you're feeling right now. A lot of parents, Colette, say that all they want for their kids is for them to be happy. But I think that can so easily lead to just giving children whatever they want. What are some more constructive hopes for us to aspire to for our children?
I agree. Actually, this is a question I've been asking in all my seminars lately. So I start off and I say to parents, what are your hopes for your child? Now, I've actually started to preface that with saying, what are your hopes for your child, but moving beyond the word happiness? Because we want our children, obviously we don't want our children to be sad, but happiness is often based on feelings. And I think there's many things in life that don't make us feel happy right now. I personally do not love cooking. I don't feel happy cleaning. I would feel happy after the cleaning's been done. You know, I would have quite happily stayed in bed rather than get up when it was raining.
Yeah.
That doesn't make me happy. So there's many things we do that are part of life because we need to contribute to family or society. So I think our goal as parents is not to rescue our children from everything by making excuses for bad behavior or school assignments not being done. Interestingly, research indicates that neural connections form and deepen most when we make mistakes doing difficult tasks rather than repeatedly having success in the easy ones. In other words, when we feel happy all the time, we're actually not learning and growing.
Mm.
So it's important to cultivate outward-looking mindsets in our children, not inward-looking. So saying no to our children when they're not getting their demands met is healthy. Otherwise, we breed a sense of entitlement and disrespect. So positive goals are to instill values, I think, in our children to contribute to their immediate society, the world that they know, so family life, family chores, having a sense of social justice, developing character, and being a good friend at school. These things are important, and I think as parents we need to model them and help our children practice them in our day-to-day.
Yeah, that's right. And that is definitely going to say involve saying no from time to time.
Yes, absolutely.
Yes. Thank you, Colette. There's some great advice there. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Katrina. Thanks for having me.
That's Colette Smart. You can find her online at familysmart.com.au. Do you agree with Michael Cargreg that too many parents don't say no to their kids? Have your say right now on the Hope 1032 Facebook page. More than a quarter of all Australian households are people living alone, and that number continues to rise in all age groups. It's expected to reach 30% by 2026. But are people living alone by choice, or is it due to circumstances beyond their control? Got Joanna Hayes from Celibate in the City on the line. G'day, Joanna.
Good morning, Katrina.
Now, you're living alone, kind of, aren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. How long have you been living alone for?
Well, this will now be my third year of living by myself. Although it is a bit weird at the moment because I live alone in a two-bedroom apartment, but it's inside the college that I work in.
Mm-hmm. So there are always people around as well.
There are always people around.
Do you prefer to live alone? Do you consider it to be a choice?
So initially I was terrified.
Uh-huh.
It was something I both craved and yet was just so scared of because, you know, like every other normal person, I'd grown up in a family, so living with people, and then had lived with people. It wasn't something that I had done before.
Mm.
So I was really, really scared about it. But actually, it has turned out to be a really wonderful and empowering experience, and I think it'll be weird having to live with people again.
So what do you enjoy about living alone?
So one of the things that eventually became difficult about living with other people, and I think we chatted about this a bit last week in discussing the problems of housemates, is when you're trying to each live your own life and yet share the same space together, making decisions about who are you going to have over and when and what are you doing that night and who's using this space and who's away and who's not, all just became really complicated. Whereas when you live alone, would you like to have someone over for dinner tonight? Well, yes, I would. Okay, let's invite someone. The arguments become a lot less complicated when you only have to discuss it with yourself.
Are there some difficulties, though? That's kind of one of the obvious things, is that you can sort of do what you want when you want. But are there difficulties along with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, like most other people, I was afraid that I would die alone and be eaten by Alsatians. And I did actually black out and wake up on my bathroom floor a couple times because it turns out that I have panic attacks. And it's not the greatest feeling thinking, okay, I don't know how long I was unconscious for and no one else knows I'm here. You know, that realization that you're quite vulnerable in that space. And also, I think a large part of it is a lot of people who are living alone aren't living alone by choice, and there's a vulnerability to that as well. You know, often there have been circumstances leading to people living alone that haven't been great. So a spouse dying or leaving or family moving on. So, yeah, there can be a lot of vulnerability in living alone as well, and it makes some things a lot harder. Even just simple stuff like, I want to rearrange the furniture in this room.
Yeah, I would need to fix a tap or something, or the light bulb.
Yeah, yeah.
Someone to hold the ladder while you go up on the roof or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not someone who likes to be alone, but the reality is most of us will have to live alone one day. For me, that idea is rather terrifying. Have you discovered ways to make it less lonely? Because I think that's what people are really afraid of more than the idea of being, you know, eaten by an Alsatian or whatever, is of loneliness.
Yes, absolutely. So I think one of the things is some of us need to learn or embrace the fact that being solitary isn't the same as being lonely, or being alone for a little while isn't the same as being alone forever. So kind of remembering that, okay, I'm alone in my house at the moment because it's 7 o'clock in the morning and I'm getting ready for work, but I'm going to see people and I have relationships and I'm going to keep engaging in those. Really, the main thing is just to keep putting yourself out there. And frankly, that's going to be easier for you as an extrovert who loves people than for me as an introvert who pretty much would almost spend every day alone if I could anyway. So I think, you know, if one of the things that you're worried about is the loneliness of living alone, you actually have a great amount of ability to make it not lonely by reaching out to the people in your life and inviting yourself to their house is a skill that you might need to pick up. But also, you know, engaging with them and inviting them into your life. And it can actually be a really wonderful part about living alone.
Yeah, okay. Good to hear the positive sides, because we're all going to be in that position at some time or another in our lives. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks, Joanna. It's Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net. We've been talking about some of the challenges and the benefits of living alone. A parliamentary inquiry looking into homeschooling has suggested that there may in fact be many more children being homeschooled in New South Wales than the amount that are registered. So I wanted to hear from you if you've homeschooled your kids. Why did you do it? What did you get out of it? What do you think are the advantages and disadvantages? Fiona called in.
I've just finished homeschooling my kids for a year.
Ah, and why did you end up homeschooling them for a year?
Because I had been working full-time and I had previously homeschooled my... I've got four kids, four boys.
Yeah.
I previously homeschooled my two eldest boys before they went to school. They'd never been to school. I just homeschooled them and then I sent them to school. And I just got so much out of that, and they did too, just for their development and just time with them. My younger children knew about it, but they'd always been to school and they'd kept saying, "Mum, you know, when are we going to be homeschooled?" So I just made the commitment and I quit my job and I just spent a whole year homeschooling them.
It sounds like for you it was the quality time together that was appealing about it.
Yeah, there was that for me. I think that's what I got out of it. But also, one of my sons had a lot of trouble going to school. We had we'd moved around a little bit interstate, and they'd really suffered that loss of you know, having to change friends and moving house. And I think that once we decided we're going to stay at this school, he just wasn't settling very well. And I just really felt actually God say, "Look, it's okay. You can just take some time and just do it." Although he actually struggled with the sitting down and doing the work aspect, he did do it. He did get through it, but he really benefited from that time with me. And now he's at school. He's so much more settled. I don't know if it's because he's older or because we homeschooled. I don't know. But
it's interesting. You're obviously not someone who's... It sounds like you're not anti the traditional school system at all. Whereas I think that's probably a perception people might have about homeschoolers, that maybe they don't trust the system, or that they're in some way wanting to work against the system. But it's like you've used both, and I think that's really interesting. What do you like about the traditional schooling as opposed to the homeschooling as well?
I love the fact that you can send them off to school and you've got the rest of the day. I love it, because you don't have that choice when you're homeschool. They're at home with you all the time, but the pressure's off too, because you don't have to get them out the door. Yeah. I look forward to the holidays, because I don't have to get lunches ready. I don't have to do all that routine and drive. We drive a significant distance to get to school. So I love the relief of being at home, the freedom.
Did you not go mad, though, with four boys with you all the time? Like, did you have to make sure that you got breaks?
I confess to you, I gave all my boys the opportunity to do homeschooling again, and the eldest one said, "No, Mum, I want to stay at school." So I started off with three, a high schooler and two middle primary. And then after two terms or a term and a half, the year seven boy said, "No, Mum, I want to go back to school." Okay, fine. So I ended up with two at home.
Yeah.
So it wasn't all four for the whole year.
Yeah.
And when I previously homeschooled years ago, I had two school age and two babies.
Mm.
So, yeah, that was a challenge. But I guess, again, I had the freedom to just, you know, spread my time and pace myself. And
Fiona, you sound like an unusually open-minded individual. You're obviously very confident in your own abilities as a mother and a teacher, but you're also happy to trust others with that. And I think that's kind of the best case scenario. So, yeah, good on you.
I think it's good to what is that? Is it called interdependence?
Yeah.
Where you know you can draw from others. You know, you grow yourself. And I'm not saying I'm all totally that, but I think I like to think that there's no one way to do things.
Yeah. Well, I know for me personally, I really value the input of others into my children's life. I like the idea of them having I don't want to have. Like, obviously, I'm their mum and I'm going to have a big influence on their life, but I also feel like I want other people to invest into them and them to see other ways of doing things and other ways of solving problems and other ways of approaching things, different personality types, etc. So, yeah, it's interesting. Thank you so much for your call, Fiona.
That's
great to hear from you.
That's
yeah,
all right.
Appreciate it. Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Beatrice phoned in to have her say.
I did homeschool.
And what made you decide to do that, Beatrice?
I thought that the regimented system that was available wasn't suiting my sons. They wanted to be more active.
Ah, yes. Yeah. So this is often an issue, isn't it? Boys being locked down in a classroom, not being able to move for 6 hours a day.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we'd be at the beach at 6 o'clock, boogie boarding and doing all sorts of physical activity. Then there'd be bike riding and all that, get them, you know, all the energy out. And then we'd sit down and, you know, have a nice hot breakfast and then start lessons and go until about 12. And then in the afternoon, they'd have friendship group or we'd have a joint. There's different groups around Sydney that do different activities like science or math or whatever. And we joined the science group.
Beatrice, I want to ask you, did you stick with homeschooling throughout their whole education or was it just for a time when they were in that really active phase and they just couldn't sit still?
Just for a phase. And then they went back to school. I was never one of those homeschoolers that said, oh, I'll never put them back into school. I thought, you know, I'm going to leave it up to them.
Yeah.
And when their maths got really advanced and my son was really good at math, and I thought, oh, you know, I need to get a university student to come in and tutor. So she came in and she said, oh, he's really good, you know, but he needs to be pushed a little bit more. How about putting him back to school? And I said, okay, we'll give that a go. I found a school that, you know, nothing is perfect. Homeschooling is not perfect. School's not perfect, but you compromise and you see what's best for your child. I found a good school where he went there for 2 weeks and said, yep, love it. So he stayed there and I just homeschooled my just one other son. And he's got, you know, a skin disorder, a genetic skin disorder, so he can't wear shoes. And so it was a more difficult process of finding a school where that would be okay. The school that my older son ended up going to said that was fine. They'd work around that. He's fine there and he's in year nine there.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Great. Well, thank you. It sounds like sometimes there's a need for a greater flexibility or something that the Department of Education can't always offer. That's another reason people end up homeschooling, yeah?
They're both doing really well, happy kids, and that's what I wanted.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for your call, Beatrice. Great to hear from you.
Thanks. Bye. Thanks.
And I spoke to Dee, another homeschooler.
Well, the reason I chose is different to the reason I continued. Initially, we had our child enrolled in 4 different schools, weren't happy with what we saw coming out. This is before he hit 5. Took a trip to the States, came back, and went, you know what, I think we can do this. We were on call. Our hours were really strange. But the reason we've continued it now, this is my 22nd year of home educating, is just the relationship between the kids and myself and parents is just amazing. It allows their creativity to be fostered. I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Okay, so basically you think it's really enhanced your relationship with your children because you're investing all that into them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
How do they go, though, with just in general, you know, fitting in to the rest of the world? Because they spend so much time with you, do you never worry that it's going to be harder for them to fit in with others?
Oh, absolutely not. I've actually got 5 children, only one left at home. We're involved in a lot of sport. We're involved in a lot of after-school activities and their social side doesn't lack whatsoever.
But do you think it's important as a homeschooler to make sure that that happens?
I do, 100%.
Yeah.
We meet with other home educators weekly, doing, you know, classes, Latin classes, debating, you know, just general playing It is very important.
Yeah, you've made it a priority to make sure they're not insulated just within your home group.
Yeah, and they're involved in youth groups and charity groups, and it's often the first question I get is, well, what about socialisation? But we automatically assume that sending a child to school is positive socialisation. I think we'd be naive to think that that's the case.
Yeah, even obviously it's going to be a mix of positive and negative, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. And that happens even with us. Look, even at soccer, where we, you know, interact with many others, there are things that they have to deal with. You know, they may not be the best in the team, and there's social interaction that occurs, and they have to deal with that peer pressure, you know, there. So it is important to have them out socialising. One thing I did want to point out is that I notice with kids at school that they're able to interact with children their own age, but the beauty I find with home educators is they can sit on a bus and not only talk to kids who are their age, they'll start a conversation with an adult or an elderly person, and it's not just aimed, their communication's not just aimed at their own peer age, but they're able to interact with anybody because they don't have that constraint around them.
Where they're not just used to just being with people
same age group. That's exactly right, yeah.
Oh, interesting thoughts. Thank you for your call today.
No problem.
Yeah, good to hear your thoughts. Thanks,
okay.
Dee.
Okay, bye.
Well, yesterday was Hope 103.2's Miracles Day for CBM. We were asking you for a donation of just $32 to restore the sight of one person. We had such a great day. And to find out how we did overall, I've got Rob from CBM on the line. Hi, Rob.
Hi, Katrina. How are you?
Yeah. Well, look, we had a great day.
Amazing.
How did you go with your overall results?
Our overall total... We set out to get 10,000 miracles, and right now our total is standing at 17,043. So
fantastic.
That's unbelievable.
That's like nearly double.
It is. It's over double what we did last year. So it's staggering. It's not dollars. It's not just a number. It actually is 17,046 people who will have their sight restored through the cataract operation. So.
That's really fantastic. We really wanted to thank our very generous listeners, Rob, too, because we set this really ambitious target of trying to get 2,000 donations, 2,000 people, you know, with their sight restored. I believe we went over and above that, didn't we?
You did, well and truly.
Yeah.
Well, truly went kind of over 10% above that, 2,230, I think, was the figure that I'm looking at here, and that's amazing generosity. We really want to thank you, Hope 103.2 listeners. We do take our sight for granted in Australia, and even for people with vision impairment, there's a lot of supports and facilities, but in the remote areas where we work, that's not the case.
Yeah. Well, I think the really special thing is that it's not just the 2,000 people who will now be able to see, but it's all the impacts that has on freeing kids up to go to school and, parents back to work and all that. It really affects the whole community, doesn't it?
It's always a family and a community impact. Yeah. One person's disability within a family has a huge impact. So, it's very exciting.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Rob. I'm glad we could make it work.
Yeah. Thank you very much. And really thank all your listeners, Katrina. That's just a wonderful, wonderful effort.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you so much if you gave yesterday. If you didn't, it's not too late. You can still donate through our website at hope1032.com.au. But thank you so much to everyone who did support Miracles Day yesterday. Michael Gongor is best known for his work with the musical collective Gongor, who have received several Grammy nominations. Now, while it's hard to pin their music down to any one genre, it's been called alternative, folk, and experimental. Michael Gongor is also the author of the book The Crowd, The Critic, and The Muse, a book for creators. And that's what we're going to talk about today. He's on the line from Nashville, I believe, in the United States. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how's it going?
Not too bad. Let's go right back to the beginning. I understand you grew up in a fairly fundamentalist church environment. What impact did that have on your creativity?
In the upbringing that I had, I was brought up with a lot of boundaries on what was appropriate to create, and it had to be very functional within the confines of my sort of tradition and religious world. And as I grew and as I began to travel and see the world outside of my own little hometown, you know, I think the world got bigger and started realizing over the years that maybe God was bigger than some of the confines that I had limited him to. And maybe, you know, maybe everything that's beautiful kind of belongs to him. If he's the source of beauty and the source of all that is good, maybe anything that is good and beautiful and true in some way speaks of and reflects God. And
it sounds like you're moving from being brought up to believe that you should create things only for maybe a specific purpose to think more broadly about the creative process as being something spiritual.
Yeah, it's creating itself as kind of central to even what it means to be a human being is, you know, I love in the Genesis account when it talks about man being made in the likeness of God, in the image of God. And some of what you see the early humans tasked to do is, you know, kind of take care of the garden, name the animals. And it's kind of bringing order into creation. You know, it's reimagining and kind of shaping the earth. And so that's like a central job. It's what it means to be human and what we've done with the world, what we all do with our world, whether with art or with our work, whether you're a mom taking care of her kids, an accountant crunching numbers, we're all just ordering the creation around us.
Yeah. Now, in the beginning of your book, you talk about coming out of a place of burnout. What did you learn from that?
I find that when I'm kind of running low on creative fodder, when I'm having a hard time coming up with stuff, a lot of times, you know, I think there's a tendency sometimes when you have work to do, there's stuff to be done, especially if it's creative at all, to try to force something or almost like scraping it out of their soul rather than having it be an overflow and of kind of the abundance of the soul. So I've found that for me when I'm burning out, a lot of times is tied to output versus input on some level. And that can be anything from creatively to just personally. I'm kind of an introvert by nature. And if I don't find a good balance of life, of enough stuff coming in, you know, you got to breathe in as much as you breathe out, and otherwise you'll die. So finding ways of feeling like I'm inhaling, and that whatever that is, you know, I'm reading good books, I'm having good conversations, I'm having enough solitude, just it really comes down to rhythm of life to me. And you have to be breathing in as much as you're breathing out, otherwise yeah, you burn out.
And so what are some of the other more common barriers to creativity?
I think fear is a big one because fear tells us all sorts of stuff. The book, you know, called The Crowd, The Critic, and The Muse, all those, the crowd and the critic, both external and internal critics, can kind of shut us down. And we have these things that we dream of, things we'd love to make, things we'd love to do. Anytime that anything worthwhile happens in the world, there's always going to be some resistance. And if you really do something good or beautiful or novel, you're definitely going to have people that oppose it. You know, anything that happens that makes waves is rocking somebody's boat on some level. So fear kind of makes you want to just stay in a safe zone, in a predetermined zone within the confines of what your tribe or whatever's around you finds, you know, acceptable. And that makes for safety, but it kind of makes for bland work and bland art. Faith, you know, like religion, can tend to capitalize on fear because it can be a good motivator to get people to fall into line with what you want them to do. So, and that's an unhealthy religion, I think. When religion really capitalizes on fear and trying to make people feel on the negative emotions, on guilt and oppression and fear, to try to get them to fall into place, rather than what I see in the early followers of Jesus and through history, followers of Jesus that did amazing things, they're often the ones that walked against the fear, and often the culture and the world were terrified of them and hated them and killed them, including Jesus himself, and because they didn't fall into line. Christianity has always been, historically, you know, especially in the early days, it was counter-cultural. It was like this, it was a revolution. And so I do think that there's something within the modern expression of religion that can tend to go that way for sure. And you see that in a lot of religious culture and religious art, I think, is kind of a safety and a blandness and a fear. And I know as a person that has written songs for people to sing in church and stuff at times, I know that there is a machine that really wants to have you stay in place. And if you ever kind of veer at all, there's pushback for sure. Okay. But again, it's also a human thing, so I'm sure it's everywhere at some level.
Yeah. In your latest blog post, you wrote, "Faith is not something to be reduced to a set of propositions that we all agree about, but rather a surrender." I thought that was a really beautiful and poignant quote. What roles do faith and doubt play in the creative process?
Yeah, doubt is one of those things, especially, I don't know how it is in Australia, but in the United States, especially in the more conservative, fundamentalist, evangelical world, there's kind of this, and I think this is a very modern phenomenon, but this need for certitude. It's like faith has become less something other than faith and trust and hope and belief and surrender. It's become almost like the scientific method, where you need to know these things that are true, and you need to mentally assent to that, and that is what makes you on the right team, and that's what makes you acceptable to God, and that's what gives you grace, if you just make sure that you know all the right things.
That you have certainty.
And yeah, and that's not faith. That's like, there is no faith without doubt, because faith is trusting. None of this might be true, but I'm going to have faith. I'm going to choose to believe, and but my faith is by how I live. It's a wager. It's a wager of my life. Like, what am I gonna bet? Am I gonna bet that God is love, or am I gonna bet that it's all meaningless and doesn't matter what I do, and I'm just gonna do whatever I feel like in the moment? I'm gonna take, you know, and everybody has to make those sorts of decisions. And I think that's what faith comes down to. You know, doubt can help purify faith, because rigid, like, fundamentalist certitude turns into authoritarian, which can do lots of bad things in the world, you know? I mean, it's that same, all the crusades and the witch hunts and...
Well, even what we're seeing now with Islamic fundamentalism, I suppose, right? We've just seen a guy get his head chopped off because of that.
Exactly. Because, these ideas somehow become an authority and a certitude that you can justify any sort of violence with your certainty that you're in the right position. And that's what causes so much violence and evil in the world. If there was a good, a healthy amount of doubt with some of those people that are chopping heads off, is this really in the spirit of the faith that we think we're holding to? Like, doubt helps you ask those questions. It keeps you in line.
We've talked a little bit about not listening too much to the voices of the crowd or the critic in terms of what determines your art. At the same time, though, you know, where people like you bravely go off in different directions, you do cop a lot of criticism. So how do you make sure that you're robust enough to deal with that criticism when it does come?
Yeah, I'm particularly, I don't know how much it's spread in Australia, but the social media this last week for us went crazy. I don't know, there was some American online magazine that took some things that I had written years ago about how I read Genesis more metaphorically, and kind of used it to say, Gunger doesn't believe the Bible anymore, and Gunger doesn't, so kind of turned into this crazy online frenzy over here. And so, yes, I'm kind of in the middle of a lot of criticism even right now, and it's hard. You know, you really have to find out how to, sorry if it's a little cheesy, but to build your house on something other than the sand, you know what I mean? Like, you have to find a way of anchoring your life. And I do have a little bit of a personality where I can kind of laugh at some of it and just enjoy the silliness of everything. but I can't say that no part of it ever stings, or that I want people to like me. You know, but I also know that if I'm going to believe something is true, or if I'm going to believe in good and try to live my life in a direction like that and not just be washed up by whatever is the loudest voice in my head telling me to sway this way or that, I just have to prepare myself. Like, if I want to call myself a Jesus follower, I'm following a guy that eventually got executed, and all of his closest followers got executed. So I just got to know that if I'm going to try to say things that are true and beautiful and good, there's always going to be pushback. And so trying to, like, not, I guess it's just a daily kind of letting go, almost like a surrender of what am I gonna base my heart and my life in today? Is it gonna be, am I gonna go search online for my name and try to please the people that don't like me, or am I going to just do what I do and be who I am and be okay with that. And yeah. It's just a decision, you know.
Okay. Well, thank you. I've been speaking with Michael Gunga. We've been talking about his book, The Crowd, The Critic and The Muse, A Book for Creators. Thank you very much for your time this morning, Michael.
Yeah, thanks.
And now let's hear some of his music. This is I Am Mountain on Hope 103.2.
I am mountain, I am dust, constellations made of us. There's glory in the dirt, a universe within the sand, eternity within a man. We are ocean, we are mist, brilliant fools who wound and kiss. There's beauty.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with Life Words. Subscribe to Hope 103.2's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.